Disc 36.
One of his, Johnson's, aides had assured McNeil early in the week, he's too smart to stay stuck all the way through. He's too quick on his feet. But in fact, McNeil noted, Johnson had stayed stuck all the way through. He is a skillful cloakroom and Senate floor operator, but a national convention is not the Senate. The same techniques don't apply. And those were the assessments of friendly journalists. Drew Pearson gloated that Lyndon ended up looking like a cellophane bag with a hole in it. Dreading humiliation though he did, Lyndon Johnson had brought a form of humiliation, ridicule, on himself. There were also less objective, more rational reasons for Lyndon Johnson to grimace, considerations that were much more serious than a failure to stop other candidates. Johnson's foremost priority before the convention had been to avoid being labeled as the Southern candidate. So overriding was this objective that his tactics had revolved around it. To achieve it, he had refused to seek Southern delegates, had, in fact, declined the Southern states' offers of delegates. And yet that label had been pinned on him, quite firmly. Arthur Crock had flatly called him a sectional candidate, and James Reston had ridiculed his attempts to pretend that he wasn't one. Describing Chicago as a place full of fantasy in which normally serious, intelligent, experienced men sweating under the presidential fever can convince themselves of anything, Reston said that one of these illusions was that Lyndon can persuade himself that he is really a national and not a regional figure. In a sentence that must have been particularly hurtful to Johnson, Reston said that he is playing in this convention the role played by Richard Russell of Georgia in the last. And the label fit, as the actual balloting had proved. The only state besides his own which had voted for him was the most segregationist state in the entire country. Not only had he been tagged at Chicago with the label he didn't want, Lyndon Johnson had also been given dramatic, devastating proof of how damaging that label was to his chances for national office. Not only in 1956, but in any future year. He had learned for himself, the hard way, what before he had known only by observing the fate of others. You could not win a presidential nomination as the Southern candidate. Even had he kept the South solid in Chicago, as he could so easily have done simply by early and openly avowing his candidacy, the South would still not have been able to play a decisive role in the convention. It had, after all, been while the South was still holding aloof from Stevenson that Stevenson had wrapped up the nomination with Northern votes. Influential, even decisive, as the South was in the Senate, with its chairmanships and its filibuster, in a national convention it had only 262 of 1,373 votes, and that wasn't enough. It was those huge non-Southern blocks of delegates that a candidate needed. Michigan's 44, Ohio's 58, Illinois's 64, California's 68, Pennsylvania's 74, New York's 98. If you wanted the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party, you had to get votes from the North. And, Lyndon Johnson had learned the hard way in Chicago, there had never been any realistic possibility that he would get those votes. He had entered the convention believing, and had, after Truman's intervention, believed even more firmly on the Monday and Tuesday of that frantic week in Chicago, that he had a chance of getting at least some significant liberal support. And he had learned beyond possibility of misunderstanding, that there was no chance of that, and never had been. He had thought he could split the North, but the North wouldn't split, in large part because its antipathy toward him was so strong it didn't want to give him an opening. One of the arguments most effective in persuading Northern delegates to unite behind Adlai Stevenson, in fact, had been the argument that if they didn't, Lyndon Johnson might exert significant influence at the convention, might even become the nominee. New York might not even have held firm behind its own governor if it looked like a coup by Johnson was in the making. Johnson may have been aware before the convention of the depth of Northern antipathy to him, of the implacability of liberal resolve to deny power to him or to any other Southern candidate. He could hardly have been unaware of this reality, having watched from a ringside seat as it crushed Richard Russell in 1952. But just as Russell had not understood the reality, understood it emotionally as well as intellectually, until it struck him personally, so Johnson had not understood it fully. When Jim Rowe had awakened him at 5 a.m. to tell him that Michigan was going for Stevenson, his reaction had been, "I don't believe it." But he had to believe it now. Chapter 36. Choices. Two international crises in the fall of 1956, the brutal Russian suppression of the Hungarian uprising, and the escalating Mideast conflict over the Suez Canal, rallied Americans behind their president, whose smile was as fatherly, reassuring as ever. Dwight Eisenhower's landslide popular plurality in his rematch with Adlai Stevenson approached 10 million. Adlai won only 7 states, all in the South. The Democrats hung on to Capitol Hill, however, overcoming Earl Clements's medical discharge from the Senate to hold their 49-47 margin there. When Congress reconvened in January 1957, Lyndon Johnson would still be majority leader. Down in Texas, furthermore, with Sam Rayburn and the state's conservative establishment behind him, Johnson had solidified his power in the state's Democratic Party by ruthlessly putting down a liberal uprising. Freed from the restraints of civility imposed on him in the Senate, his tactics had been very blunt. He ordered Texas congressmen and their aides to determine which delegates to the party's state convention were flirting with the liberals. And these delegates, one congressional aide said, were confronted by their banker, preacher, lawyer, congressman, brother, and threatened unless they got back in the fold. Some were confronted by Johnson himself in his most aggressive, lapel-grabbing, chest-poking mode. Holders of federal or state jobs were asked in a tone described as ferocious how they liked their jobs. To others hoping for jobs, Johnson made the price clear. "If you don't help me, you ain't never going to get to be a judge," he said to one. Johnson had supported County Judge Woodrow Bean in an intra-party convention fight, in return for Bean's promise of support from his El Paso delegation on other issues. When Bean was unable to deliver, Johnson called him in and, glaring at him and jabbing his forefinger into his chest, demanded, "You with me or against me?" When Bean tried to explain his dilemma, Johnson cut him off. "Woodrow Bean," he said, "I'm going to give you a 3-minute lesson in integrity, and then I'm going to ruin you." And he had the convention's credentials committee decertify Bean's entire delegation. Nonetheless, during the post-election weeks of November and December 1956, Lyndon was in one of his black depressions. Not getting the Democratic presidential nomination that year had proven to be something of a blessing. The election results had convincingly reaffirmed that no one could have beaten Eisenhower. But the lesson he had had pounded into him in Chicago, that you couldn't win the nomination as the Southern candidate, that you had to have substantial Northern support, and that Northern antipathy to him ran very deep, had devastating implications for his chances to win the nomination in 1960. He understood now that there was only one way to change his image in liberals' eyes, to support the cause that mattered to them above all others, that so long as he didn't change his position on civil rights, it didn't matter what he did for them on other issues. That hard fact of Democratic political life was being reiterated that December in a letter written to Paul Douglas by Herbert Lehman. "In all fairness," Lehman wrote, "it must be said that the Democratic-controlled 84th Congress did pass some fairly good legislation in fields like Social Security and health research. But the civil rights issue was buried alive. This could not be allowed to continue," the New York liberal said. "We must put principle above so-called party unity." "Lyndon Johnson will not learn this," Lehman said, "cannot or will not learn it. Therefore," he said, "Johnson must be removed as leader." "I want to run the Senate," Lyndon Johnson told allies in private conversation. "I want to pass the bills that need to be passed. I want my party to do right. But all I ever hear from the liberals is nigra, nigra, nigra." He knew now that the only way to realize his great ambition was to fight. Really fight aggressively and effectively, for civil rights. In fact, it was probably necessary for him not only to fight, but to fight and win. Given their conviction that he controlled the Senate, the only way the liberals would be satisfied of his good intentions would be if that body passed a civil rights bill. But therein lay a seemingly insoluble dilemma. That way, the only way, did not seem a possible way. Because while he couldn't win his party's presidential nomination with only Southern support, he couldn't win it with only Northern support either. scrubbing off the Southern taint thoroughly enough within the next 4 years to become so overwhelmingly a liberal favorite that he could win the nomination with Northern votes alone was obviously out of the question, so dispensing with Southern support was not feasible. He had to keep the states of the old Confederacy on his side. And yet a public official who fought for civil rights invariably lost those states. The problem seemed one without a solution. Lyndon Johnson's path to power had always been a hard, treacherous, twisting path. Had it now become too twisting, too tortuous, for even him to negotiate? During the months following the 1956 election, Lyndon Johnson tried to make himself more appealing to liberal Northerners, tried, in the words of one, John Kenneth Galbraith, to cultivate us to some degree. He asked for their pity, delivering a memorandum from Paul Douglas to Johnson's office in the Capitol one day that December. Douglas's administrative aide, Frank McCullough, accustomed to being treated by Johnson with disdain as the representative of the despised professor, was surprised to find that Johnson was making an effort to be friendly. Inviting him into his private office, the leader had him sit down for a chat, and after a few minutes asked in an earnest, sincere tone, "Frank, why do the liberals hate me?" McCullough responded, "Senator, they don't hate you, but they certainly are displeased by your positions and your conduct on some of the key issues on which the Democratic Party has taken a position." But Johnson said that no, it was personal, that liberals just didn't like him, he didn't know why. "He was appealing to me for sympathy as an object of hatred. I tried to explain that they really cared about civil rights, about justice, and that he kept opposing. But I can't recall that that argument, fazed him in any way. He just kept on about the personal stuff, about people's attitude toward him, about how they just hated Lyndon Johnson, speaking in a gloomy, mournful tone. No, Frank, they just hate me, and I can't understand why." He tried to charm them and to impress them, to convince them of his selflessness and altruism, of his utter selflessness, total altruism, of his complete lack of interest in political advancement, of the absolute absence in his makeup of any personal ambition whatsoever, and to make them appreciate the difficulties he had to face as Democratic Senate leader, and the brilliance with which he overcame them. And he tried to convince them as well that he was on their side, that he had always been on their side, that he was more liberal than they thought, particularly on civil rights. Jim Rowe and George Reedy had made him understand the growing importance in liberal intellectual circles of 39-year-old Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr., a noted Harvard historian with the gift for incisive phrase-making, and he wrote Schlesinger inviting him to call on him the next time he was in Washington. And when Schlesinger did so, coming to his office on a Saturday, Johnson pulled out all the stops. It was a memorable conversation, or to be more precise, monologue. It lasted for an hour and a half, and although Schlesinger, never known, as a friend says, for his shyness, had prepared a long list of questions, Johnson talked the whole time, almost without interruption. First came the disclaimer of ambition. According to an aide-mémoire which Schlesinger wrote after the conversation, Johnson reminded him that he had had a heart attack. He was a sick man, he said. He had no political future, and he didn't want one. His main desire, he said, was to live a few more years. He had no interest in the presidential nomination. He wasn't cut out for the presidency anyway, he knew that. In fact, he said, he wasn't even going to run for the Senate again. All he wanted to do was to serve out his present term. Being entirely disinterested, he wanted only to do the best he could for his party and his nation in the 3 or 2 or 1 year remaining to him. Then he could go back to Texas, where he belonged, and live out whatever few years the good Lord gave him in peace. Then he turned to the Senate, as only Lyndon Johnson could. That morning, Reedy had given Johnson a memorandum on how to handle Schlesinger. "He is a man of genuine intellect, and I think all you really have to do is leave him with the feeling that Senate leadership may be much more complicated than he has realized." That was indeed the feeling that Johnson left him with. In what Schlesinger's memo calls a stream of consciousness on the problems of leadership in the Senate, Johnson described the problems of keeping the conservative Southerners, he called them the Confederates, and the liberal Northerners in the same harness. He analyzed a number of insoluble parliamentary situations which he had mastered through his own brilliance and perseverance. He gave a generally fascinating account of the role which timing, persuasion, parliamentary knowledge, etc. have in getting bills through. Then he turned to the individual senators, the other 48 Democratic senators. "I want you to know the kind of material I have to work with," he said. Schlesinger was to recall that he didn't do all of them, but he did most of them, in a performance the historian was never to forget. Senator by senator, Johnson ran down the list, each man's strengths and weaknesses, who liked liquor too much and who liked women, and how he had to know when to reach a senator at his own home and when at his mistress's, who was controlled by the big power company in his state, and who listened to the REA cooperatives, who responded to the union pleas and who to the Grange instead, and which senator responded to one argument and which senator to the opposite argument. He did brief but brilliant imitations. When he came to Chavez, whose trouble is alcoholism, Johnson imitated Chavez drunk. Very funny. And who, Lyndon Johnson demanded, had to make all these diverse temperaments and philosophies work together? Who had to unite them into a workable majority? The leader. He had to do everything, he said. It was as if his senators were a football team. He had to be the coach, he had to be the quarterback and call the signals, he had to be the center who snapped the ball, and the running back who ran the ball, and the blocker who blocked for the running back. To demonstrate, he lunged out of his chair. "I'm the center," he said, bending over and snapping an imaginary ball. "I'm the quarterback," he said, taking the ball and throwing an imaginary pass. "I'm the end," he said, holding out his arms to catch the pass. "I'm the runner," he said, tucking the ball under his arm and taking a charging step or two across the office. "And I have to be the blocker, too," he said, and he threw a block. And finally, Lyndon Johnson came to the crucial point that he wanted Schlesinger to understand. He seemed quite annoyed, Schlesinger wrote in his aide-memoir, that the organized liberals do not regard him as one of their own. "Look at Americans for Democratic Action," Johnson said. "They regard me as a Southern reactionary, but they love Cliff Case. Have you ever compared my voting record with Cliff Case's?" I said no, I hadn't, whereupon he opened his drawer and pulled out a comparison of his voting record on 15 issues. On each one he had voted for the liberal side and Case for the conservative side. "And yet they look on me as some kind of Southern bigot." He added that maybe he was showing undue sensitivity to liberal criticism. "But what a sad day it will be for the Democratic Party when its Senate leader is not sensitive to liberal criticism." In particular, Lyndon Johnson said, there was the civil rights issue. On that issue, he said, the liberal feeling toward him was particularly unjust. "I've never said or done anything in my life to aggravate sectional feeling," he said. "Why," he said, "every time he ran in Texas, he had the support of Negroes because he had treated them fairly during his term as NYA director." "Maybe," he said sadly, "the Northerners won't be satisfied until they split off and try to form a party of their own. But all that would do is destroy the Democratic Party, and the Northerners would not get very far on their own, for several reasons, among them the fact that the Southerners were better politicians." There was a postscript to this conversation. During it, Schlesinger got to say very few words. "I had carefully thought out in advance the arguments to make when asked to justify my doubts about his leadership," he was to recall. But in the course of this picturesque and lavish discourse, Johnson met in advance almost all the points I had in mind. When he finally paused, I found I had little to say. After nearly 2 hours under hypnosis, I staggered away in a condition of exhaustion. But evidently even a few words were more than was required. When, some months later, Galbraith, Schlesinger's friend and fellow Harvard professor, was visiting Johnson in Texas, Johnson said, "I had a good meeting with Schlesinger. I found him quite easy to get along with. The only trouble was that he talked too much." Another liberal object of his attentions were the Grahams of the Washington Post, and Johnson's courtship of them was at its most effective, for it took place on his native heath. In December 1956, Phil and Kay finally accepted his open, insistent invitation to the Johnson Ranch. From the moment Lyndon loaded them into his car at the little Fredericksburg airstrip, it was a typical Johnson Ranch weekend. The ritual visits to the birthplace, to the little family graveyard on the riverbank, and to the stone barn in Johnson City, The stories about the Johnson forebears who had fought the Indians from that barn, about the Johnson brothers who had driven the great herds north to Abilene, about his grandmother, Eliza Bunton, who had ridden out ahead of the herd to scout, and who had, during a Comanche raid, hidden under her log cabin and tied a diaper over her baby's mouth so it wouldn't make a sound. And the rituals and stories made vivid and believable one of the points he'd been trying to make to Northeastern liberals. That while Texas was certainly below the Mason-Dixon line, he was, because of the part of Texas from which he came, not really a Southerner, but more a Southwesterner. The idea was that they were fighting Indians and they were pioneers, this Southwestern kind of pioneering, Catherine Graham recalls. And it was my animals and my ranch. You see him ride over those acres, it was like he was saying, "This is my background and my roots." After that visit, I understood him more. A glowing profile of Johnson that appeared in the Washington Post shortly after the Grahams returned to Washington showed how well Phil had grasped the point. On the civil rights issue, Johnson has always taken the traditional Southern view, but it may be well to remember that Johnson is from the highly individualistic hill country of Texas, which seldom echoes the prejudices of other sections of the Deep South. Where did Johnson acquire those unusual, persuasive qualities which enabled him to walk into the middle of a party split on almost any issue and come out with an agreement? The story is that he inherited his talent from his father, Sam Ely Johnson, Jr. Others say it traces from old grandfather Sam Ely Johnson, Sr., who predicted that his grandson would be a senator the moment he laid eyes on him. In any event, Johnson's antecedents root deep in the country around Johnson City, which his forebears settled in the 1840s and battled the Comanches to keep. The article was written by Robert Albright, but Johnson knew whom to thank for it. "I know how much I owe to you," he wrote Phil, "and any time I can donate an arm, a leg, or anything else to the Graham cause, you can count on it." On his home ground, Lyndon Johnson was, in Mrs. Graham's words, sort of overwhelming. He sort of smothered you with hospitality and with charm. There was the invariable insistence that the guest shoot a deer, whether the guest wanted to or not. Phil, who loved hunting birds, in part because they are hard to shoot, which meant he mostly missed them, couldn't stand the idea of killing a deer, Mrs. Graham recalls. When they came upon a small group of deer standing on a hill and Johnson told Phil to shoot, he couldn't bear the thought, and with the gun on his shoulder hesitated until the deer turned away from them and started to leave the scene. Then when Johnson shouted, "Shoot, Phil," Graham said, "I can't shoot him in the ass, Lyndon," as the deer bounded away. Spotting another group of deer a few minutes later, Johnson stopped the car again and again ordered Graham to shoot. "I can't, Lyndon," Graham said this time. "He looks like little Beagle Johnson." But, Mrs. Graham says, instead of laughing and accepting Graham's reluctance, Johnson grew angry. Phil realized he had no choice but to comply, and he shot his deer. Later, Phil and Lyndon laughed over the episode. And there was the time spent cementing his bonds with the visitor. After dinner, he and Phil would sit for hours and drink and talk in the big living room with the frontier-sized fireplace. As she and Lady Bird sat mostly silent, Mrs. Graham says, Lyndon slouched down, Phil bending his elbow, political talk, political gossip, people talk. One after-dinner session didn't add much cement to the bonds between Lyndon and Mrs. Graham. Lyndon started complaining about journalists, she says. This was par for the course for any politician, of course, but in the middle of his diatribe, Johnson made a remark that she felt went beyond the usual limits, saying, "You can buy any one of them with a bottle of whiskey." "I was much too reticent to enter into the conversation or to object," Mrs. Graham says. "But when Phil and I went upstairs, I denounced Lyndon for saying what he said, and Phil for letting it go unchallenged." "How could you sit there and listen to that?" she demanded. "How could you?" Johnson's parting gifts did not improve the situation. Phil's present was a 10-gallon Stetson, hers a charm bracelet with charms attached, including one in the shape of Texas, and another of a microphone. "When it hit my hand, it was so heavy I realized it was gold," she recalls, and in the context of Johnson's remark about the press being purchasable, it rankled. She asked her husband, "Should I give it back?" It's just what he was talking about, but he said not to, that they would return a gift of equal value, which they did, sending Johnson a water purifier that he had mentioned needing. In addition to the customary rituals, during the Grahams' visit there was an added note, a concentration not only on the publisher but on the publisher's wife, to make another point that Johnson wanted liberals to understand, that it was not through idealism and speeches that civil rights would be attained. Philip Graham had for some years been trying to persuade Johnson to take the lead on civil rights. Phil always wanted Johnson to be president, Joe Rau was to say. Maybe that was because of his, Graham's, feeling for the South. Graham had grown up in Florida. That he wanted a Southerner to be president. He wants to make Johnson president. Well, you got to clean him up on civil rights. Graham had been pushing Lyndon on its importance from the beginning of their relationship, Mrs. Graham was to say. Since the publisher was himself pragmatic and realistic, Phil and Lyndon were completely comfortable with each other on the issue, but as she puts it, Lyndon regarded me quite differently from Phil, as one of the flag-waving red-hots who couldn't understand that their methods were not improving the chances for social justice. And during this visit, looking straight at me, separating me from him and Phil, he kept making that argument, prefacing each supporting point by saying, "You Northern liberals," hammering points home as though trying to explain to me how the world really worked. Illustrating the message was an anecdote which Mrs. Graham would always think of as the story of how civil rights came to Johnson City. "You liberals," Lyndon Johnson said, "you think that you fight for civil rights in the North. Well, I want to tell you how civil rights came to Johnson City." And he launched into a story about an incident he said had occurred during his boyhood when a road was being built through the town and the road gang included some negras, which according to Mrs. Graham's oral history was how Johnson pronounced the word. At that time, Lyndon Johnson said, niggers weren't allowed to stay in Johnson City after sundown, but the road was coming nearer and nearer, and obviously the foreman of the road gang was planning to have the gang sleep in town. The town bully found the foreman in the barber shop and said, "Get them niggers out of town," Johnson said. And then he said the foreman got off the chair, took the towel off his neck, put it aside, and they wrestled up and down Main Street. And finally, Johnson said, the foreman got on top and took the bully's head in both hands and started banging it against the pavement, asking with each bang, "Can I keep my niggers? Can I keep my niggers? Can I keep my niggers?" Until finally the bully agreed that he could. "And that's how civil rights came to Johnson City," Lyndon Johnson concluded. The story was, of course, told with the customary Johnson vividness. "It was rather a marvelous example. I think he's the best storyteller in the world," Mrs. Graham would recall years later, and showing Johnson pounding an imaginary head down with both hands and shouting, "Can I keep my niggers? Can I keep my niggers?" she would break into a fond smile of reminiscence. And it had a very clear theme, that, in Mrs. Graham's words, that was how civil rights could be accomplished, not by idealism, but by rough stuff. That he, not the speech-making Northern red-hots, knew how to get things accomplished for civil rights. He was, Mrs. Graham recalls, saying that, "I was an idealist, this theoretical Northern liberal, and he, Lyndon Johnson, was a practical fellow, and that it was through practical means, rough stuff, that things got accomplished." With Schlesinger and the Grahams, this cultivation bore fruit. Shortly after their return to Washington, the Grahams told Jim Rowe about their visit to the ranch, and Rowe informed Johnson, "You certainly did a remarkable selling job there. They wasted at least an hour of my time telling me what a remarkable man you are." Schlesinger's impression of Johnson was recorded in his memoir to himself. "I found him both more attractive, more subtle, and more formidable than I expected." And the historian said, "One got the sense of a man with a nostalgic identification of himself as a liberal and a desire, other things being equal, to be on the liberal side." In other liberal fields, however, the seeds Johnson tried to plant after the 1956 elections fell on stonier ground. When Schlesinger told Joe Rau of Johnson's contention that he was not running for the presidency or for the Senate in 1960, Rau just laughed heartily. He said anybody who will believe that will believe anything. Among most liberals, in fact, no planting was even possible. Their antipathy toward the majority leader was far too strong to permit informal or social attempts at conversion to the Johnson cause. And overtures he had others make on his behalf to liberal journalists like Doris Fleeson or Thomas Stokes, to liberal labor leaders like Walter Reuther or Alex Rose, or to members of the New Deal Fair Deal pantheon like Eleanor Roosevelt and Harry Truman, were notably unsuccessful. He could not, during these months just before the opening of the 1957 Congress, effect any significant change at all in prevailing liberal opinion about him, in part because to so many liberals the memory of earlier battles was still fresh. "What did he think, that we would forget what he did to Leland Olds?" says Alexander Radin of the American Public Power Association. "Well, I never would, I can tell you that." But largely because of his more recent record on civil rights. Stokes described the anguish and guilt of Democratic Northern leaders who are scouring themselves for compromising with the Southern wing of the party and permitting the Southern leaders to shove civil rights legislation under the rug at the last session of Congress, and at the National Convention to put over a mealy-mouthed civil rights plank without even making a real fight against it. To other Northern leaders, it was the recent cruelty to Paul Douglas that left the bad taste in their mouths when they thought of Lyndon Johnson. The first weeks after the election brought, as well, fresh signs that in 1957 the liberals were going to take the field again for social justice, and that in their view Lyndon Johnson was still very much the enemy. Declaring that the Democrats are digging their own grave by inaction in the field of civil rights, Hubert Humphrey announced that on the first day of the new session, he and five other liberal senators would jointly introduce a 16-point Democratic Declaration, a liberal legislative program highlighted by strong civil rights laws, and would also attempt to remove the main barrier to the program's enactment by introducing a motion to repeal Rule 22. Fleeson predicted that Johnson would, as usual, oppose the motion because Johnson is a Southerner, deeply obligated for support and counsel to Southerners. Clarence Diggs, the African-American congressman, said that if Johnson was unable to support the motion, he should resign as the party's Senate leader. Schlesinger's growing admiration for the Texan was most decidedly not shared by most of the historian's fellow members of the ADA's executive committee, who, while not going as far as Diggs in demanding Johnson's outright resignation, passed a resolution asking him to recuse himself during the Rule 22 fight and not use his post to betray the Democratic platform. ADA Chairman Rao regards the pivotal position of Lyndon Johnson as a major block to effective liberal legislation, Irwin Ross reported in the New York Post. Before the 16-point declaration had even been announced, Rao said, its six senatorial sponsors, afraid of Johnson's power, had watered it down so that it would be harder for Lyndon to complain. Another coalition of liberal leaders, the National Committee for an Effective Congress, accused Johnson of wanting to be the Democratic spokesman nationally, in a position tandem to that of the president, and said that because of his views on civil rights, he must not be allowed to have that role. One after another, leading liberals made the same point. None more eloquently than the New Yorker, who in the Senate may have been almost an object of ridicule, but who outside it, among liberals everywhere, was an object of reverence. In a valedictory interview he gave over the Christmas holidays of 1956, just before his retirement, Herbert Lehman told Irwin Ross that while he might be leaving the Senate, he was not leaving the fight, and that no matter how hopeless the fight seemed, it should be continued. "A fight is worthwhile even if you know you're going to lose it," he told Ross. "It's the only way to crystallize attitudes, educate people, and in the end, I've seen many hopeless causes win out." Looking back at the 1920s, when it had seemed impossible to win social advances that were now an accepted part of American life, he said, "We were called radicals and dreamers, but we were willing to wage seemingly hopeless fights. In the same way, we will get complete school desegregation, and Negroes will get the right to vote in the South. These things are coming, quicker than people realize." Liberal dislike and distrust of Lyndon Johnson was not confined to idealists and intellectuals. At one Democratic conference, a speaker referred to the great victory the party had achieved in retaining control of Congress despite Eisenhower's huge plurality. The next speaker was that most practical of politicians, Colonel Jacob M. Arvey of Illinois, who commented caustically, "All this talk about a great victory is fine. I think we scored a great victory. I also think we got hit by a truck." And the colonel said, "If 1958 is to be a Democratic year, it may be necessary to get a few new pass catchers on the Democratic team." An attempt was made to institutionalize the opposition. In a secret meeting near the end of November, Arvey and other seasoned professionals, liberal professionals, on the Democratic Executive Committee, instructed National Chairman Paul Butler to formalize the challenge to the Southern leadership in Congress by establishing a high-level Democratic Advisory Council to shape a party legislative program that would not coincide with but challenge Eisenhower's policies. Galbraith, one of its members, said that the purpose of the 20-member council was to take some of the Texas image off the party. In the New York Times, Russell Baker said bluntly that it is a challenge to Senator Lyndon B. Johnson of Texas. Butler publicly invited Johnson and Rayburn to join the council, a tactical mistake on two counts. First, by including Rayburn, he infuriated scores of Democratic congressmen who took the formation of an advisory council as a personal insult to their beloved Mr. Sam, particularly because of his accomplishments in liberal causes. "I don't think any outside committee can undertake to advise Rayburn," said veteran Ohio Congressman Michael Kirwan. As Interstate Commerce Committee chairman, as majority leader, and as speaker, he pushed through the House all the important laws of the New Deal and Fair Deal. "Certainly I can't advise him. Who are they to advise him?" Second, by issuing a public invitation, without ascertaining beforehand whether it would be accepted, Butler allowed Johnson and Rayburn to decline publicly, and to make sure that other congressional invitees followed suit, in a statement that emphasized the council's powerlessness by saying that a legislative program could only be promulgated by legislative leaders. "The first blood has gone to the congressional leadership of the party," Gould Lincoln wrote. But with liberal icons like Lehman, Stevenson, Harry Truman, and Eleanor Roosevelt as members, the Democratic Advisory Council could hardly be ignored. "Our fight has just started," Butler said, and his efforts were supported by liberal editorial writers, columnists, and cartoonists. They made it clear that the civil rights issue was not going to go away. Supporting the move to repeal Rule 22, the New York Times said that, though similar efforts have failed before this, the interests of democratic government require that it be made again and again and again, until at last it succeeds as it eventually will. "It is a travesty to wrap the mantle of free speech around the filibuster. That is exactly what the filibuster is not." And in words and pictures, they also made clear what side of the issue they felt Lyndon Johnson was on. In the months since the Democratic Convention, the label he had worn there had been pasted on him more firmly than ever. Even his supporter, Arthur Kroc, had to note that the criticism of his tactics at the convention had now been revived. That he used his influence, with calamitous consequences, to induce the convention to appease the South in the party platform plank on civil rights. Conceding that the senatorial signers of the Democratic Declaration had little power within the Senate, the nation told its readers that that was not the point. "The Declaration," it said, "is an important document because it is the first major move in a campaign to reconstruct and rehabilitate the Democratic Party, and because it was also a vote of no confidence in the leadership of Senator Johnson." A Herblock cartoon on November 28th showed a Senate liberal handing Johnson a paper labeled "Proposals for Cloture and Civil Rights Legislation." In one hand, Johnson is holding a waste paper basket in which he is going to deposit the paper. His other hand, hidden behind his back, is holding an outsized gavel with which he is preparing to knock the liberal on the head. When, furthermore, hard-eyed men in both parties, the poll-takers and strategists to whom politics is percentages, began analyzing the 1956 election results, certain percentages leapt out at them, those in the columns headed Negro. The trend among African-American voters, which in 1952 had so disturbed Democrats and so encouraged Republicans, had intensified in 1956, they realized. In 1952, The 68% of the black vote that Adlai Stevenson had polled had been far below the percentages that Democratic strategists had come to expect. In 1956, Stevenson's percentage was 61%. Of all the major groups in the nation's population, pollster George Gallup reported, the one that shifted most to the Eisenhower-Nixon ticket was the Negro voter. And at the same time that the Democratic share of the Negro vote had declined, the size of that vote had grown. Not in the South, of course, where a mere 15% of eligible Negroes had voted, but in the North. For between 1952 and 1956, the Negro exodus to northern cities had continued. The concatenation of these two trends, an increase in the black vote and in the percentage of that vote going Republican, intensified the hopes tantalizing the GOP. It was in the big cities of California and the North's eight big industrial states that the Negro vote, perhaps 3 million black voters, had been concentrated in 1956, and from every available evidence, as the Democratic pollster Richard Scammon told his clients, during the next 4 years that vote will continue to increase. This possibility provided the GOP with a great opportunity to take the big states and thereby to be able to hold the White House even without an Ike at the head of the ticket. The more closely that these trends were analyzed, congressional district by congressional district, ward by ward, the more attainable that prospect appeared. The larger the Negro population in a particular district or ward, the larger had been Eisenhower's margin of gain between his two elections. The heart of New York's Negro population, for example, was the city's 16th congressional district, Harlem. And in Harlem, where once a Republican presidential candidate counted himself lucky if he received 10% of the vote, Eisenhower had received 17% in 1952 and 34% in 1956. In Illinois' first congressional district, Chicago's South Side, his share had increased from 25% to 36%, and even a 50-50 break in the up-to-now heavily Democratic Negro vote might well push key doubtful states into the Republican column, Scammon concluded. The Democrats might then be denied the White House until some new major adjustment of American political forces shifted the balance their way. And, strategists saw, a key reason for the Republican trend among African-American voters remained: the Democrats' control of Capitol Hill. The Negro voter, by and large, appears convinced that it is the Democrats who prevent any legislative help in his race's striving for a better share in American democracy, the Atlantic Monthly reported. The Negro voter, and the white voter too, who feels strongly on the subject, sees only Mississippi Senator Eastland blocking the door of his powerful Judiciary Committee and backed by Southern Democrats determined to filibuster any civil rights legislation. NAACP lobbyist Clarence Mitchell, speaking to NAACP branches across the country during the 1956 campaign, had said that a heavy Negro vote for Republicans would automatically eliminate 21 Southern chairmen from the key committee posts they now hold. Campaigning in Harlem, Vice President Richard Nixon had told audiences that civil rights legislation cannot pass as long as the filibuster exists in the Senate. He also said that if Eisenhower was elected, "We are going to have performance on civil rights, not just promises, because Eisenhower is going to have a vice president who opposes the filibuster." The effectiveness of such pleas had been documented in the upsurge in the GOP vote in Harlem. Said Mitchell after the campaign, "Seldom in the long political history of our country has a man been so helpful in defeating members of his own party as Eastland." Democrats knew Mitchell was right. Returning to Washington from Oregon, where he and his wife, Maureen, had made more than 350 speeches urging the re-election of Wayne Morse, Richard Neuberger said that although less than 2% of Oregon's population is colored, "We are continually confronted with the charge that a vote for Senator Morse was a vote to continue Senator Eastland as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee." There was a further disturbing note for Democrats. The concentration of northern Negro voters in the city's ghetto wards, together with gerrymandering that kept the Negro vote confined to those wards, meant that the shift in that vote toward the GOP had not yet been heavily felt in elections below the presidential level. But as U.S. News and World Report said, if the shift continues, it could affect the choice of aldermen, city councilmen, and scores of House members. This kind of political fallout in Negro precincts is causing major recalculations of party strength all over America. The recalculations were going on in both parties. Once a basic Democratic belief had been that the party could not afford to alienate the South. Now there was a new calculation. The 11 Southern states had a total of 128 electoral votes, and that figure included Texas, which Eisenhower had carried twice, and whose 24 electoral votes could no longer be considered safe for a Democratic presidential candidate. Without Texas, the South's electoral vote was 104. The 9 key northern states had 223 electoral votes. Accustomed, though Capitol Hill had become, to discounting Hubert Humphrey's extravagant rhetoric, his remark that the Democrats were digging their own grave brought many nods in Democratic offices. The civil rights dilemma loads down the Democrats in the North as the old man of the sea sat athwart the shoulders of Sinbad the Sailor, said Senator Neuberger. Unless the party's stance on that issue was changed, the result could be banishment for the Democrats for many decades from the executive branch of government. Long indispensable, the South might, suddenly, now be expendable. And while Democrats were constrained from taking full advantage of these new calculations by another reality, a change in the party's stance might alienate the committee chairmen who were so important a source of its strength, no such constraint operated on the GOP. Republicans had little to lose and a great deal to gain. "Give us a civil rights bill," one Republican leader told James Reston, "and by 1960 we will break the Roosevelt coalition of the large cities in the South, even without Eisenhower." No sooner had the 1956 election results been analyzed than Republican leaders began laying plans to exploit the situation. And among these leaders were the party's two leading candidates to succeed Eisenhower, both of whom, as it happened, were from California, with its 194,000 Negro voters, which meant that both men had been sensitized to the potentials of black voting power, and both of whom, as it happened, were there in the Senate chamber with Lyndon Johnson, one of them, William Noland, seated just across the aisle from him, the other, Richard Nixon, on the low dais just a few feet away, his eyes almost level with those of the tall majority leader. Noland, the Taft acolyte whose passion for civil rights had heretofore been extremely well concealed, now unequivocally promised the NAACP's Mitchell that he would lead the fight to pass a civil rights bill in 1957. As for Noland's rival, as Marquis Childs said, "One thing even Nixon's bitterest enemies have never denied him. That is a sure understanding of the main chance." And, Childs wrote, Nixon was "working with all the intensity of a very intense nature, trying to shape for his party a strategy to position it on the right side of the issue that contributed more than any other to the Republican landslide of last November." Nixon's ally, of course, was Brownell, and the Republican Attorney General had lost none of his enthusiasm for his proposed bill that would give the Justice Department unprecedented power to enforce a broad array of civil rights, the bill in whose inherent aims and political possibilities he deeply believed. Within a few days after the election, it was known that the Brownell bill would be reintroduced in 1957. In 1956, it had been introduced late in the session, late enough for the Senate to avoid confronting it. But the Senate would not be able to avoid confronting it again. Since the 1956 election, there had been a further escalation of white hostility in the South. When the new school year had begun in September, before the election, there had been only minor progress in the 17 states which, before the Brown decision, had required school segregation. Of the 2,731,750 Negro school children who were in school that September in the 17 states, some 115,000, 4%, were in schools also attended by whites. And even that small figure was misleading, for almost all of those 115,000 were in border states. In the 11 former Confederate states, 3,400 of Texas's 248,000 Negroes were in integrated schools. A total of 1,200 more were in integrated schools in Arkansas or Tennessee. 3 years after Brown, that was the extent of Southern compliance with the court's decree. And as John Bartlow Martin found on his tour through the South that fall, in recent months resistance to school desegregation has been hardening. In most of the Deep South, he reported, there is no prospect of school integration in the foreseeable future. State legislatures would be convening in January, and scores of bills had been introduced that would have the effect of nullifying the educational integration decree. In Virginia, they were introduced by legislative members of the Byrd machine. There was no time to lose, Harry Byrd said. A federal judge had issued a ruling designed to force integration in Virginia. We face the gravest crisis since the war between the states. If laws were not passed to circumvent the ruling, he said, 6-year-old children of both races would be assembled in little huts before the bus comes, and the bus will then be packed like sardines. What our people most fear is that by this close, intimate social contact, future generations will intermarry. The chairman of the Senate Finance Committee called for massive resistance to all such court rulings. Law enforcement, he said, should be by the white people of this country. Other bills dealt with voting, intending to make it more difficult for African Americans to register. Not that such legislation seemed particularly urgent, for while black voting had been rising sharply in the North, in the South voting statistics were little more encouraging than those on schools. Among the more than 6 million Negroes in the 11 Southern states who were 21 years of age in 1956, only 1,238,000 had been registered, still only 1 in 5. There were entire counties in these states, counties in which thousands of Negroes lived, in which not a single Negro was registered to vote. In Mississippi, the number of registered Negroes may actually have declined during those 4 years. Further increases seemed likely to come even more slowly. 5 states still had a poll tax, and in all the Southern states the use of literacy tests and of outright intimidation, economic and or physical, was increasing. A new tactic, wholesale challenges by citizens' councils representatives of Negro voters on a county's registration lists, had been instituted in 1956, and it had proven effective. In one Louisiana parish, more than 3,000 of the 4,000 registered Negroes had been purged from the registration books shortly before the 1956 election, and its use was expected to increase. The number of Negroes who actually voted in the South may actually have been smaller in 1956 than in 1952. Nor was it only in schools and voting that the South was strengthening its defenses. The legislative hoppers of the South are spilling over with legislation aimed at keeping the Negro in his place, Stan Opatowski of the New York Post found on a tour of the South in December 1956. One bill that was about to be introduced and passed in Louisiana specifically prohibited the performance of George Gershwin's musical Porgy and Bess, since it raised the possibility of blacks and whites appearing on the same stage. It also prohibited the annual meeting of the state Red Cross, since a previous annual meeting had been attended by Negroes and whites. Anger was escalating everywhere in the South. In the white citizens' councils, the South had found, in John Bartlow Martin's phrase, a flag to rally round. And in 1956, as in 1955, tens of thousands of white Southerners joined their rolls. One huge rally followed another. The council's vigilance extended into areas previously not thought of. Incensed that some of Southern Bell's party lines were used by both black and white subscribers, Mississippi's Monroe County Council demanded that the company segregate its telephones. The council's targets included not only Negroes, but white Southerners whose racial views, while perhaps not pro-integration, were unacceptably moderate. They too, Opatowski found, are subjected to the same terror if they dare stray from the most rigid segregation line. There is a consistent and insistent attempt to force all white Southerners into a rigid pattern of defiance of the courts and to a position of rigidity on every aspect of the race question, said Morris B. Abram, president of the American Jewish Committee. And these enormous pressures, Abram said, were succeeding. The field is being preempted by the extremists. The white citizens' councils had the South, the white South as well as the black, firmly in its grip. "The domination is total," Opatowski wrote. "There is no middle ground, no shade of gray, only black and white. And woe betide the black." Reported Martin, "The Deep South is solid once more." Even more ominously, a growing number of Southern whites were not satisfied with the council's actions. There was, the New York Times reported that December, an upsurge by the frustrated elements that want more boldness and action. The Ku Klux Klan, in disrepute for more than a decade because of its violent redneck tactics, was again on the rise. That fall, Martin reported, it has burned crosses in the fields and paraded openly through many a small town. And the Klan, as Opatowski pointed out, does not claim the niceties which the councils wear as their mantle. They're back to flogging again. In one incident in Camden, South Carolina, a white 52-year-old high school music teacher was taken from his car, tied to a tree, and beaten with tree limbs and with a wooden plank by a group of men in white hoods, because it was thought that he had advocated school integration. Only later was it learned that the beating had been given to the wrong man. The music teacher had, in fact, opposed integration. Everywhere in the South, violence was rising. That November and December 1956, in the wake of the victory in Montgomery, it had been a week after the November election that the Supreme Court ruled Alabama's bus segregation ordinances unconstitutional, Negroes had begun bus boycotts in other Southern cities and were trying to integrate schools and parks as well. Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the organization created to launch civil rights protests all across the South, was organizing for its first meeting, which would be held in Atlanta on January 10th. Southern whites were reacting to this new black determination with new fury. The bombings of Negro homes and churches increased. More snipers fired on integrated buses. In one incident in Montgomery, a Negro woman was wounded in the leg, and when more shots were fired at the bus, it headed for a police station with its passengers lying on the floor. There were new attempts on King's life and family, including a shotgun blast fired into their home while they were sleeping. In Birmingham, Fred Shuttlesworth had announced that he and other Negroes would sit in the front rows of city buses on the day after Christmas. On Christmas night, a bundle of 15 sticks of dynamite exploded beneath Shuttlesworth's parsonage. The next day, he and a score of other Negroes were arrested on the buses. Police in other Alabama cities also ignored the Supreme Court ruling, arresting Negroes who sat in front. On the eve of the 1957 session of Congress, Southern bombings, beatings, sniper fire, and cross burnings were not stopping, but increasing. The perpetrators evidently felt they could act with impunity, and again they were proven correct. Every time black leaders asked Brownell to take action to stop the violence, the Attorney General had to reply that under existing law, the authority for maintaining interstate law and order rested with the states, not the federal government. Two white men had actually been arrested for one of the bombings of Martin Luther King's home and had given and signed confessions. A Montgomery jury, all white naturally, had acquitted them nonetheless. "Deep Southern resistance," John Bartlow Martin wrote, "is righteous, determined, and sure of success. At the outset, it probably was buying time. Not today, and they believe they have desegregation stopped. This is not a few loud-mouthed rabble-rousing politicians. This is all but unanimous white opposition." He had taken a tour of the South to determine when the South might integrate its schools, and he gave his conclusion in the title of the book he wrote, "The Deep South Says Never." The region's attitude was personified in the Georgian who in 1956 drove gentlemanly old Walter George out of the Senate. George's new senator was Herman Talmadge, son of Gene Talmadge, hero of the Wool Hats, the Georgia governor who, during the 1930s and 40s, had been the incarnation of the suspender-snapping, tobacco-chewing Southern race-baiter. While he had not actually been a member of the Klan, Gene once said, "I used to do a little whipping myself." Herman was smoother, but just as unabashed a segregationist. As governor, he sponsored a state constitutional amendment allowing Georgia to close her public schools rather than desegregate them, and to send white and Negro children to separate private schools. Sitting contentedly in his stately home, filled with echoes of the Civil War, When we remodeled, we dug a few old mini-A balls out of the house. The only reason it was not burned was that Sherman occupied it. He told Martin, they couldn't send enough bayonets down here to compel the people to send their children to school with niggers. Talmadge's election to the United States Senate in November 1956 was by the biggest majority in Georgia's history. To Clarence Mitchell, says Mitchell's biographer, the supplanting of George by Talmadge was a tragedy that reaffirmed the South's intention to stick to its unconstitutional way of life. The South was determined that its position on segregation would in fact be hardened, that this new civil rights agitation would be defeated. And when Southern strategists surveyed the situation, they were confident that it would be defeated. For, after all, if all else failed, they still had their Senate citadel, where they still held their chairmanships and their subcommittees. When Congress reconvened in January, it would be faced again by the Brownell Bill. But although that bill had been passed by the House in 1956, it had been blocked in the Senate, and if necessary, it would be blocked there again. And back in the states of the Southern senators, the rising rebel yell was not for compromise, but for victory. Lyndon Johnson was in residence at the Johnson Ranch over Christmas vacation in December 1956. So early each morning, Mary Rather would walk down to the Perdinalis, passing the family cemetery with its big live oak, and then across the river on the low water bridge to collect the mail from the large, slightly tilted mailbox. That December, late in the month, among the missives that Ms. Rather found in the mail and left on the dining room table for her boss to open over breakfast, were three communications that were definitely not Christmas greetings. They were warnings. Warnings in the form of memoranda that Lyndon Johnson took very seriously because of the identity of the men who had written them. Each of the three memoranda warned him that he must act on civil rights and act soon. And each memo told him also what might never happen if he failed to act. One of the memoranda, mailed from Washington on December 20th, was from the man with whom he could not afford to argue. And it demonstrated that among people committed to the cause of social justice, not even personal affection could blunt the issue. Philip Graham had discussed the memo with his wife before sending it. In her memoirs, she would describe it as arguing that the senator needed to counteract the reputation he had as a conservative, sectional politician. The memorandum itself said that Johnson's past response to this false stereotype has been largely negative. He complains about phony liberals, he criticizes columnists and some other parts of the press, etc. And, Philip Graham told Johnson bluntly, that reaction hadn't worked, and it was never going to. The only way for Johnson to change his stereotype, Graham wrote, was for him to announce a legislative program that would make possible a congressional session marked by a high order of accomplishment. The program, Graham wrote, would have several principal themes, of which an essential one, Catherine Graham would call it perhaps the most important, was civil rights. Civil rights to be strengthened, not by phony speech-making, but by consequential action, Graham wrote. It is essential for LBJ to create and articulate a realistic philosophy on civil rights, a new civil rights program which can be embraced by people of all persuasions and which can bring reality to this general field. Bluntly, Philip Graham warned Lyndon Johnson of the consequences of not acting on civil rights. Fate's decree may be that LBJ is destined only to be a Jimmy Burns or a more energetic Dick Russell, he said. On the other hand, he may be permitted to play a truly consequential role in the mainstream of history. The only way to test the possibilities is to test them, he said. At the moment, LBJ is not doing so. The other two memos were both from the man who Johnson thought was the person who might make him pope or God knows what. 4 months earlier at the Chicago Convention, Jim Rowe had warned him in writing not to become another Dick Russell, had told him that if he presented an image of a Southern candidate, it will make it almost impossible for Lyndon Johnson to be nominated in 1960, had said that he knew that such an image is Lyndon Johnson's private nightmare. Now, in December, Rowe warned Johnson, in writing, in two memoranda dated December 13th and 21st, that the nightmare was coming true. There is, Rowe said, a growing public impression that you are the leader of the Southern conservatives. This has long worried me, and I know it worries you too, Rose said. Nonetheless, he said, it is clear to me that enough has not been done to change or stop or turn this impression. All you and I have done essentially is to point out to each other that this picture is utterly untrue. We are inclined to dismiss it. And he told Johnson, you cannot afford to dismiss it if you want to win the presidential nomination. It is time that we accept the obvious truth that a public impression is just as much a fact as anything else. That impression must be changed, quickly. To accomplish this, Roe had a number of suggestions. Some were social. Harry Truman and Adlai Stevenson will be in Washington immediately after the first of the year, he told Johnson, and you should invite them over for a drink and conciliate them. Think of what they can do to you if they are hostile. If these two men would wish to wrap the Southern candidate tag around your neck, you would have a terrible time trying to get rid of it. And some were strategic, of which the key one was that he immediately put the newly elected Democratic senator from Colorado, former Representative John Carroll, a liberal and ardent civil libertarian, on the Judiciary Committee. Your problem in the Senate in 1957 will be twofold, Roe wrote. The first is to avoid becoming the symbol of the South, and the second was linked with the first. To cut the ground out from the Northern liberals by at least appearing to cooperate with them. So on civil rights, Roe said, you should be ready to give the civil libertarians something which they already have. Carroll's appointment to judiciary would accomplish this because it would be meaningless, Roe said. The appointment of a civil liberty senator to the judiciary is nothing special because they already have a large majority on the committee. Johnson had Reedy write Roe a letter temporizing on the appointment, and Roe didn't press the subject, but in subsequent telephone calls he did press the larger point, that to win the 1960 nomination, Johnson must make himself more acceptable to the North, and the only way to do that was by passing civil rights legislation. Otherwise, as Roe was to say in an interview years later, the Northern bosses were just not going to take him. The Negro problem just wouldn't allow it. The memoranda were not the only warnings from Washington delivered on the same subject to the Johnson Ranch that December. At least one other came in a telephone call from the Capitol from another man whose advice Lyndon Johnson took very seriously. Tommy Corcoran was, as always, much blunter and less diplomatic than his partner Roe, and told Johnson flatly, he was to recall, if he didn't pass a civil rights bill, he could just forget the 1960 nomination. These were warnings to a man who didn't need warnings. Johnson already knew what he had to do in 1957, Roe says. As Doris Kearns Goodwin was to write, the issue of civil rights had created a crisis of legitimacy for both the Senate and the Democratic Party. And therefore, the issue was a crisis for Lyndon Johnson. In a sense, in the journalistic view, the public view, Lyndon Johnson was the Senate, its majority leader, the senator who would be held responsible for its actions. If the Senate appeared ineffectual, incapable of dealing with the issue, he would appear ineffectual, incapable. If it appeared sectional, Southern, racist, he would appear sectional, Southern, racist. Furthermore, as far as the Senate was concerned, he was the Democratic Party. If the party looked ineffectual or racist, the blame would fall on his head. If the party split, the chasm between Southern and Northern senators becoming unbridgeable, the responsibility for that would fall on his head also. And the issue was, in addition, a crisis for him in terms of his personal ambition. As Goodwin wrote, as a man with presidential dreams, Johnson recognized that it would be almost impossible for him to escape all responsibility for the Senate to act, that failure on this issue at this time would brand him forever as sectional and therefore unpresidential. Lyndon Johnson had no choice, and he knew it. Recalling the situation years later, he would say, one thing had become absolutely certain. The Senate simply had to act. The Democratic Party simply had to act. And I simply had to act. The issue could wait no longer. Something had to be done, he said. He understood as well the consequence of failure on this issue. I knew, he said, that if I failed to produce on this one, my leadership would be broken into 100 pieces. Everything I had built up over the years would be completely undone. Producing on civil rights seemed almost impossibly difficult, however. To win the Democratic presidential nomination, Lyndon Johnson had to keep the support of the South. And the key to keeping that support was not passing civil rights legislation, but rather stopping it from being passed. Moreover, despite his success in chipping away some of the South's power in the Senate and concentrating it in his hands, the South's senatorial power was still immense. In 1957, Southerners would be the chairman of no fewer than 5 of the Senate's 8 most powerful standing committees, and their ally Hayden would be chairman of a 6th, Appropriations. On the key committees and subcommittees, they were stacked, in fact, more deeply than ever. On appropriations, for example, there would be, in 1957, in addition to Chairman Hayden, 11 other Democratic members. 8 were Southerners, 2 were senators who voted with the South on appropriation bills. Exactly 1, the most junior member, was a vote of which the Southerners could not be confident. Even if he decided to pass a bill, could he pass it? In a confrontation with the majority leader, the chairman might still win. And it was not winning that was the most crucial point, for if there was a confrontation between Johnson and the South, Johnson might no longer be majority leader. The leader was elected by the Democratic caucus. In 1957, there would be 49 Democratic senators, so only 25 votes, a majority of the 49, would be necessary to remove him and pick a new leader. Even without his own vote and that of the other Texas senator, Price Daniel, and possibly Gore of Tennessee, the South would still have 19 or 20 of the necessary 25 votes, and it could always muster the few necessary additional votes from its allies. And where would he get votes? From the liberals, whose every meeting was an exercise in denouncing him? From the liberals like Paul Douglas, whom he had repeatedly humiliated? Even if Johnson changed his stance on civil rights, could he really count on liberal support? And how many liberal votes were there in the Democratic caucus anyway? 9 or 10 for certain, that was all. If the South turned against him, he could be voted out of the leadership very easily. Nor would voting him out even be necessary. The South had not found it necessary to remove Scott Lucas or Ernest McFarland as majority leader. The South had simply refused to cooperate with them, and without the South's cooperation, those two men had been ineffectual, objects of ridicule. The South could do the same to Lyndon Johnson. Even if Johnson was to decide to confront the South and try to pass legislation over its opposition, was such a course feasible? Even if all the other defenses that the South could erect against civil rights legislation were somehow breached, there would remain still that last defense, the strongest of all, the defense that decade after decade had proven impregnable. Even if Lyndon Johnson decided to try to break a filibuster, could it be broken? With more senators than ever before sympathetic to the plight of black Americans, and with more Republican support due to both conscience and calculation, a civil rights bill might well command a majority of votes in the Senate. But would the bill be allowed to come to a vote?
End of Disc 36.